number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
Welcome to the Stuart Knight Show, where interesting, intriguing, and exciting people engage in unscripted exchanges of ideas, stories, and perspectives. It's not an interview. It's a powerful conversation.
Hey there, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to the Stuart Knight Show. This week, I'm talking to my friend, Julie Black. You know who she is.
And my decision will put me on track. That's why I try. For your baby every day of the week.
That's right, it's Julie Black, and she is an incredible woman. She's a multi-Juno Award-winning artist. She's performed at the Olympics. She's opened for Kanye West in Singapore, and she's performed alongside artists such as Elton John, Etta James, Jay-Z, Sean Paul, and Alicia Keys. During this powerful conversation, we talk about things such as religion and what's real, what it takes to be a pioneer as a Canadian singer, and why some people are single for a reason. How's that for a powerful conversation? Here we go! Well, hello there, Julie Black. How are you doing?
I am wonderful. How are you, Stuart?
I'm good. You're wonderful. What's making you wonderful these days?
Well, you know what's making me wonderful is my faith.
Your faith?
My faith. My faith is making me wonderful.
Okay.
Yes.
Your faith in what?
My faith in God. My faith in my gifts. Faith I have in my friends, my family.
Okay.
The faith of my fans.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah.
I'd actually love to talk to you about that, but before we go into all of them, the first one I want to ask you about, what does God look like to you when you say you've got a faith in God?
God looks like kindness.
Mm.
God to me is, you know, when I think about people doing things when they really don't even have much for themselves, like just being extremely generous, forgiving. Forgiveness is God.
Oh yeah, okay.
That's probably the most the biggest form of God, in my opinion, is forgiveness.
Has your faith in God or your idea of God changed for you growing up? I mean, I would imagine, I think, because I know this about you. I think that you were you came from a church going family as a child, and I have that right? Do I not?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Well, we were more than church going. We were church sleeping.
You were sleeping with God.
We were. You're so crazy. You know, God's supposed to be your everything, right? Your husband, your wife, your everything. Yeah, I will sleep with God too.
Hey, listen,
absolutely.
You know, I've yelled his name out a few times when I've been sleeping.
Hey, there you go. There you go. It's a whole other show.
How did it change for you then over the years, or did it change for you?
Oh, it totally changed for me. Growing up, I was afraid of God, and afraid of God in a way because we were raised to believe that if you do this wrong, you're going to burn in hell. It was a damnation type of, it was the religious side of things was really, really scary.
Sure.
Really scary. So even when, you know, I'd be afraid to, you know, of course, curse, or like if I, you know, take candy from the candy jar, I'm going to hell, I'm going to burn. I'm 5 years old, I'm going to burn in hell.
That sucks.
You know, yeah, so there was a fear, and that fear still rears its head from time to time. You know, I had to grow up and establish my own relationship with God and really just start to do the research, just really learn about this God existence,
right?
And get in touch with my own spirituality, and you know, just it's really interesting how much control religion could have. And so yeah, it was really, really scary. What's funny is my mom actually didn't start going to church. My mom used to use church as the babysitter, so she would throw us on the church bus,
right?
And we were going to church while she was home.
Well, hold on. Was there really a church bus?
Yeah.
Are you serious?
There was a church bus that would pull up on Finch Avenue. I mean, I know people listen from all over the world.
Yeah.
But on the street right outside my house.
Perfect.
And the church bus would pull up, and like a bunch of kids and, you know, some adults too, but mainly kids
right.
from my neighborhood would jump on the bus early at 8 o'clock in the morning. And church was all day. Church went until like 4. It was like
seriously?
School.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. I'm so glad my parents were atheists.
Oh my goodness.
Well, you know what, though? I'll tell you, I'm saying that as a joke, but it's the absolute truth. I did come from an atheist background.
Really?
Yeah.
Share. What was that like?
Well, you know, my parents, and it was true, though, what you talk about is how people will use church as a glorified babysitter, because for me, we had to go to church. There was pressure for us to go to church because we were living in a small town, and the only job that my mother could get in that town was to become the secretary at the church.
Wow.
Yeah. So for us, it was a case where, you can't go back to work on Monday and then you didn't attend church. So we would attend church under pressure. And of course, I'd have my parents who didn't necessarily believe in the ideas that were being shared in that space. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. However, they definitely believed in the idea of us going to choir camp.
Ah,
and that was always
everybody loves music.
I know, right? Well, that was confusing to me because I'd think to myself, why would you want me to go to? Well, it was choir camp / church camp.
And church camp, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, if you guys are, don't believe in this, why are we going to church camp? And it's not until many, many years later that I realized, oh, right, so you can go on vacation. That's exactly what it was. So
very good.
Yeah,
they
were smart. They would drop us off at camp for a week, and then the two of them would go, wherever they were. I mean, it's funny, right? Because you think about your parents at that time, you thought they were so old, but they were only They're only in their 30s.
So 30s, they're like our age. Like, oh my gosh!
Exactly.
I thought my mom was straight up ready for a pension.
Yeah, that's right.
But let me ask you this: I'm curious. Did your parents ever try to deprogram? Like, was there a time where you were in this church? Was there something that resonated with you that you're like, I want to learn more about this, or this makes sense? Or is there any confusion that happened?
It's interesting. That's a great question. And for me, I don't know. Like, I don't know, and this is me, I could be completely wrong, but I don't know how much children really want to be in church, especially when they look at the alternatives. The alternatives being playing outside, being on my bike, swimming in the lake, whatever it might be. And so for me, I think that what happened was because I was given the permission to essentially kind of tune it out.
Right.
It's not like I was pulled aside and said, oh, listen, when they're talking, don't listen. But I was definitely, I knew on a deeper level that there was no pressure on me to come home later on and then, tell my mom what I learned in Sunday school.
Right.
And so for me, it was like I got to just kind of daydream. So I never did hear... I never really heard anything. I can't even remember one thing I learned. I like being in the choir. I enjoy. And I can tell you that one thing, and I know a lot of people enjoy this about church, and I enjoyed it, was the community feel.
Yes.
That's a nice thing. A place to go where everyone sings together and everybody ends up, having fun together and talking together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not a family.
It is, right. Do you still go to church today?
You know what? I go to church periodically, but I will say I attend church, and this is where it's going to sound really interesting with technology. I attend church via my Joyce Meyer app every day.
What's that about?
So Joyce Meyer is a, she's a preacher from St. Louis, and so she has a ministry called Joyce Meyer Ministries, and she has probably 20,000 people in her congregation. But her app, every day she puts out a daily devotional and video, a 30-minute video of a teaching.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And so that's how I start my day, every day. I just got off finishing with her right before you called.
No kidding. Okay, so what'd she teach you today?
Well, today she was talking about your past. Is not your destiny, basically.
Ah, okay.
Just basically knowing that you can have a new start. As long as you decide you want a new start, you could have a new start.
Ah,
you know what
okay.
I mean? So don't be trapped in there. And it's interesting. It resonated with me because she resonates with me. She was molested by her father growing up many, many, many years and had to forgive him and take care of him before he died. Like, it's really deep.
Wow.
And so that concept of forgiveness to her even was like, it was the forgiveness that opened up. She's living a prosperous life in all aspects.
Mm.
And so, and now the confessing to you and all of your listeners that I was also molested as a child.
Right.
And so, and this was by the babysitter's son next door.
No kidding.
It took, I didn't tell my mother or my family until 5 years ago.
5 years ago?
You know, 5 years ago, I kept that with me.
How do they take it?
Well, I lost my mom. I could chuckle because my mom said, you know, you wouldn't have a mother if you told me earlier, because I would be in jail. I would have chopped him up. She would have did the whole thing about all the parts she would have chopped up and then chopped up his family and everybody else.
Yeah.
So I got a chuckle out of it, but my mom was really, it opened up dialogue for sure. My nieces were there, my nephews, because of course this isn't just a female thing. And
right.
We got a chance to really speak, and thankfully no one else went through that in my family thus far, but I'm able to now say, hey, you know, this conversation, especially in the black community, I will say, it seems like it's taboo. And I only know the black experience.
Yeah.
And so I'm just like, why are we afraid to talk? Why is anybody afraid to talk?
You bring up something that's, I'm glad that I haven't thought about this for a very long time, where I remember watching you, and I actually had met you earlier on many, many years ago. We met backstage because we were both doing something at an event, and it was very, very brief. But I remember sitting in the audience because I knew Rachel Lee Ricards.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And you guys were in that show, Dick Ink in My Hair.
Yes.
And I remember sitting in the audience. Now, I had seen Dick Ink in My Hair many years earlier when there was only like maybe 25 people in the audience.
Right.
At the Fringe Festival, I think it was. So now I saw you that night performing. I think you were doing you were with the cast for a while there. Anyway, there's the moment in that show where DeBee Young, I believe, is playing the part where she talks about being molested, I believe, maybe by her uncle. Okay. And I remember, now we both know that there was an always very large percentage of the audience was a black audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being startled by the response from the audience. Now, I wasn't sure if it was just that particular night or if it was every night. And the audience, for those who are listening to this, basically some of them were yelling out when she was describing being molested, and she was crying. She's crying on stage. It's a very emotional moment. And I had never seen anything like this. I mean, because of course, from a very, you know, I don't know, conservative, you know, white people, we can be a bit too insular in the way that we approach entertainment, and I think that we could be a lot louder and cheering and yelling. But this was a new thing for me. So what what's that about? What is it within the black community that I don't know about?
Well, in that particular play, especially, like you said, it did draw a black audience, and there was even laughter when she did that.
I know.
She did her piece. And we, at every show, we'd speak about the reactions of the whole play, and we realized that they were clear victims in the audience. That some people would get up and walk out, but a lot of times, you know, and sometimes somebody could be angry and they just start laughing.
Right.
Like, it's like, you know, it's really not funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things where that was the only reaction. That was a place of like, almost like deflection.
Right.
Like, okay, is anybody, you know, is this anybody knowing that this is my story? What could I do right now to just, even though we don't live in anybody's heads.
Sure.
But you know how that goes. Our perception of what we think people think about us could really be crippling. And so a lot of people would, and then sometimes we do Q&As and people pull us to the side and we start realizing, oh, there are true survivors. There are true victims. There are people who want to talk. There are people who need the help. It is really, 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 really heavy.
It was such a peculiar thing, and you raised such a good point, because it's true, right? Even if somebody wasn't molested, one way of making sure that everyone around them knows they weren't is to laugh out loud at this part. Which of course is the exact opposite reaction that anyone thinks that a person who's bawling their eyes out on stage going through a horrific moment would get. But it is amazing that we do this. It's no different than I remember one time, and I'm so embarrassed to say this, but I remember laughing at a funeral. And I was so young, and actually even now you've just brought another memory in my mind. I remember when my grandfather, my mother was given the news he had 2 weeks to live. He had this horrific cancer, and of course him being the macho British, living in a poor neighborhood man, he was going pee every like literally 5 minutes and thought, oh, you know, it's nothing. And then of course finds out he only has 2 weeks to live. And I was 12 years old when I had found that out, and I'd come home for Christmas vacation, and I walked in the house and there was my mom crying on the couch. And this is something maybe I'd seen my mom cry once before that in my life.
Right.
And my reaction was to laugh. And I always remember feeling so awful. I just laughed at my mother crying, but it was because I didn't know how to handle the emotion.
Yeah, yeah.
And isn't it true, though? Like, don't you think that so many of us walking out, I mean, don't you feel like so many of us are emotionally just so immature, aren't we?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because, you know, how do you, you know, it's like, imagine we go to, we're in, you know, elementary school, we go through our elementary school and there's no next level of learning. Like,
right.
Some people, our growth, our emotional growth has been stalled, has been lying dormant, has been just stagnant, because it still takes some sort of nurturing. It takes a willingness. It takes, like, total surrender, even,
mm-hmm.
to be able to grow and mature in that capacity.
Well, and what do you think needs to change in the school system as far as making sure that young children do start gaining this kind of emotional maturity?
Well, it's so interesting because I did a talk recently about, and it was a mental health symposium,
mm-hmm.
and it was to stop the stigma. And you see, it's like we focus on physical education and all the other, of course, book smarts, but there isn't mental health
right.
classes. And I'm telling you, if they could find a way to not call it mental, because you see, even growing up, you're mental. Like, the kids would just use that as,
you know,
obviously as bullying. And so I think that's what needs to change in the school system. I think we need to be educated about the brain, about just, you know, being able to identify sadness
right.
early.
Yes.
You know, there's class clowns. Oh, you're the class clown. Well, there's sadness in there. There's something
mm-hmm.
in there.
Good point. Yeah, this is definitely, my brother's a high school teacher, and he has told me so many just insane things about things that are happening in the school system, and yet how many people are just so untrained to be able to identify what's going on. Even what you just said right now, I thought that was just such a great thing, you know, the class clown. Yeah, the class clown
yeah.
is somebody who could very well be trying to compensate for feelings of depression or sadness,
right.
i.e. Robin Williams, which he did, you know, made a career out of it. One of the most depressed individuals ever, and he
yeah.
now openly admits it. You know, I one of the things that my brother has really dealt with in the school system is this immaturity with respect to homosexuality.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
wow.
It's funny because you can actually compare today what's happening to gay kids in high school to what happened to black kids in high school in places like the southern United States during the 50s.
Oh, absolutely. Wow.
Right? Just for being different, they're literally being pushed into the locker, or
right.
like literally being beaten up just for being gay.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's really sad. And it's like a lot could be done in the household.
Yes.
Like that's the biggest classroom.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's true, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, and yeah, what you know, if there's conversation, I mean, luckily there's more happening on television, that, you know, with just certain programming to help people just see some sort of perspective
right.
on homosexuality and equality,
mm-hmm.
et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But it, you know, it's kind of full circle. It's like, what's religion teaching?
Right.
You know, if God is love, mm-hmm. then how about we just love everybody?
Sure, absolutely.
You know, and it's what's interesting about someone just mentioned this to me recently too about the concept of being atheist is even to be atheist, you have to believe that you don't believe.
Absolutely, yes, it's true, isn't it?
So you believe in something,
right?
Right? So anyway, I just wanted to throw that in there because I thought that was pretty cool.
Was that a jab at me?
No jab. It's love.
I love it. I love it. Now, speaking of the household being the greatest, you know, place to learn, what would something that you can identify today that you learned in your household, one that really sticks out to you?
Oh, that women especially are the mothers of the earth. My mom, who already had her own 9 kids, took in, you know, teenagers that, you know, pregnant teenagers, took in people who just came to Canada and needed a place to stay.
Wow.
Like, my mom, yeah, like, my goodness, like, household was always, I said to my mom just yesterday, I see my mom every Sunday when I'm home,
mm-hmm.
that we never felt like we, first of all, we never felt poor. We always had the awesome food, and
right.
I didn't go without. I don't know how she did it. I'm like, Mom, I don't know how you did it.
Yeah.
And you fed others. And so that was my greatest lesson growing up, that when you have, even if it's just a dollar, you still have 50 cents that you could give.
Right, right. And you do tie that in with the female personality that women, you know, are, do you feel like they're naturally inclined to just be givers?
Well, I think giving of yourself, being mothering, being nurturing, mm-hmm. being, you know, I think we've been wired that way.
Right.
And that's just how we were wired.
Sure.
Period.
I agree.
And I think a lot of women tend to kind of shy away from that, like it's weakness.
Mm. Oh, really? You think
no, that's your power.
Oh, and why do you think they shy away from it?
Because we've now, the world has become this place of, okay, we're in the workforce, fantastic. You know, you could basically make babies in your turkey baster and all that. You don't have to, follow the natures of mother's nature's time clock, because you can have a baby when you're 60, because they'll just figure it out.
Right,
you know, they'll
right.
make you deliver it through your armpit, something. So they're buying us time. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what has allowed a lot of women to be like, well, I am super powered, lady. I don't need to be submissive. I don't need to, you know, I could go out there and I'm going to cut my hair and put on my man suit. And why is it a man suit?
Right.
Like, it's just interesting, my observation of it, especially like being in entertainment, which is the total opposite, or being an artist.
Sure.
Where we are told to like embrace our femininity, our sexuality, mm-hmm. sex sells, da 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 da.
Right.
So
right.
And then I go into meetings, and you know, in the record business, there may be one female executive in out of 100 in the building. You know what I mean? So,
out of curiosity, have you ever had moments where you've been asked, you know, as an entertainer, to I don't know, shorten the skirt or lower the cleavage, where you've actually either said no or you felt uncomfortable and you've done it?
No, I've been very fortunate. The one thing that has happened to me that has nothing to do with sexuality was they airbrushed all my tattoos off.
Oh, really?
Off of the cover of a magazine. And it was actually went through a bit of, I'm calling it, it felt very racial.
Right.
So there was another artist who was on the very same cover of that magazine that is a white woman. It's tatted up from neck to waist. Mm-hmm. She almost has a whole body tattoo. And they put her on the cover with her tattoos.
No kidding.
They put me on the cover and took mine off and didn't ask.
That is amazing. And are they are people legally allowed to do that?
Oh, well, they issued an apology. And it's kind of like when people, you know, in court where they'd be like, yeah, but I saw the blood on your hands. Objection. Well, the jury already heard you say it.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's like they did it and the magazine was out. They have a huge, you know, lots of subscribers, and it's a big magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at it and that's the one magazine that I don't, I just, it's just in my basement. Like, I don't even look at it.
No kidding. That must have been really frustrating for you.
It was hurtful. This was my first time. Cause I mean, where I grew up is very multicultural in the Jane Finch community. So I didn't experience racism. Thankfully, I didn't experience it in my face.
Right.
And I felt, that was the first time I felt like it was a racial thing.
Interesting.
Like,
and did
what's up with a black girl with tattoos? I don't get it.
And do you think, though, so you'd gone your whole life and you'd never really felt racism. I'm curious, though, did when that happened, did it bring up maybe possible subconscious thoughts? Like that? Did you notice that subconsciously maybe you had felt that you lived in a racist world and didn't necessarily consciously think about it until that point? Did that ever happen for you?
Absolutely. It opened up a real interesting can of worms that still stays with me to this day. And now I'm realizing how much race and ethnicity, and there's silent racism, especially in Canada, and there's a lot of it going on in the music business.
Oh, yeah.
Straight up.
Really? How does it happen in the music business?
Straight up and down.
How does it happen in that area?
Well, we're... they'll... For instance, I just did that laugh, that uncomfortable laugh. Did you hear it?
Yeah, I wasn't sure if that was a real one.
Yeah, that was it. No, that was that uncomfortable laugh.
Okay.
Where they started calling black music urban. Let's use that for instance.
Right, good point.
Urban music, or, you know, now in the category of You know, this doesn't happen in America. So that America, we're so glued to America that we can't help, and we're so influenced by them, you can't help but see it and experience it, be it music, be it movies, be it whatever, media in general.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I see that an artist that would normally be in the pop category is now in the R&B category, but now they're calling it urban, it's just ridiculous. Why are we afraid to say black?
Right. Right. And do you think there is there a thing called black music? Does that exist?
Well, it existed, and I think that black music exists. It still exists to an extent because it's a black experience.
Mm.
It's music made from the black experience.
Right.
Period. That's all. And that's okay. Like my experience is the only experience I know.
Sure.
So, and what's wrong with that?
Of course, right? And then,
you know,
and why do we have to label it?
Why do we have to label it? Oh, that's a whole other thing. Now, like, once upon a time, like in the 80s, even though I'm still young, but hey, let's go back to the 80s, music was way less segregated than it is now. So I would hear Whitney Houston, Bob Marley, U2, Run DMC, Aerosmith, all on the same station growing up.
Right.
Here in
yeah.
Toronto. Now I have to program my radio dials to say, oh, on this station I'm going to hear Adele, then on this station I'm going to hear Julie Black, and on that station I'm going to hear Jay-Z. And I'm like, what's going on? We're going backwards. This is like Benjamin Button.
That's a good point. That is such a good point. And you know what? And on some level, too, I find that in radio, I don't know, it's just all getting mashed together as well on some level, where it's just like, you know, every radio station will say, for example, Toronto's number one radio station. The other day I was driving, literally last week, and I heard someone say the world's number one radio station, and it's
no,
like
no
oh yeah, who are you? Like, first of all, did you survey the world? And secondly, what is it that you are doing? Like, you can't say, well, you know, we're playing just urban music, or we play just country music, or we play just pop music, and then you say,
right,
we're the number one music station. Well, no.
Right.
You're just playing one genre of music. You can't say you're the number one, right?
Thank you.
What do you think about pop music these days? I mean, you and I grew up in the same era where we used mm-hmm. to listen to, pop music. It used to be like Duran Duran,
Michael Jackson, whatever. Yeah,
Michael Jackson, exactly. Yeah. So what do you think of pop music today? Do you think you like it, or do you think it's shit?
Hey, we just dropping it like it's hot. Pop music today is cotton candy. I like to go to the fair, but I can't eat cotton candy
right
every day. So I like some of it,
mm-hmm.
some of it. But what I don't like about it is it doesn't. It's not something that lasts. Like, I still want to hear some Duran Duran and some
right.
Michael Jackson. So the pop music of today is not strong enough
mm-hmm.
to just. Last, it's not classics. They're not timeless pop songs.
Absolutely.
Anymore. Where did those go?
Yeah.
Who's making the classics? And then now, when it's pop and it does and it is good music, like in my, because music is subjective. Like, so let's say an Adele album that became popular, they'll slap an adult contemporary label on it. So it's pop, but it's AC. So that'll stand the test of time.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
you raise a very good point. That's a fantastic way to delineate whether or not a song is a great song or if it's just a mediocre song as to how long it will actually be able to last. Because we all know you can literally, I mean, I don't care what you thought about Michael Jackson, but if you're shopping at a store and Beat It comes on, your head is going to bob. And
listen,
or Billie
you're
Jean.
You're dropping those eggs in the grocery store and dancing.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's very rare that you hear a song on the radio today that you can confidently say, oh, yeah, 20 years from now, we'll definitely still be listening to that song. You know, it's funny. I was just thinking the other day, I'm writing a new show right now, a new speech. And one of the things that I'm thinking about doing is actually having a moment where I talk about pop music on stage and then I ask the audience to throw out a subject, any subject uh-huh. they want. And then I'm going to write mm-hmm. a pop song on stage in the moment.
Oh.
I'm going to get the audience to actually clap. And cause I've written a couple of musicals and I've written music for a long time. So I feel comfortable in that realm, but
right.
my goal is to show the audience just how crappy some of this music is.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to write a song on the spot.
Right.
Right here. And then that just goes to show how flimsy it is, right?
Right.
So,
right, right.
So how is music going for you these days? What's happening in your musical life?
Well, music, the creation of music is incredible. I've recorded 66 songs to get to my final 14 for Made in Canada. That's the title of the album. The struggle's still there, though.
Right.
The struggle is there where you know, growing up, I was like, okay, I want to be on radio one day. Okay, that happened, you know. Mm-hmm. Okay, then I want to do I want an album. Mm-hmm. Okay, now I'm on the fifth. However, I would never have thought that I would have to start from the same point every time I put out an album.
Wow.
Every single time I put out an album, that it's as if I'm brand new.
Right, because you assume that, okay, well, one is a stepping stone to something higher, to something higher, and to something higher.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And, you know, but I've come to realize that I'm a pioneer of a sound in this country. And so I don't know what, you know, Rosa Parks or Dr. King or anybody else went through fighting for a sound to have an actual solid place. I mean, for a community to have just the right equality.
Right.
I feel like I'm fighting for R&B to have the same respect as rock in this country and pop and country in itself.
Right, that's a great point. Because it's funny, you know, now that you're saying that, growing up in Canada, I don't remember ever, you know, being able to identify and say, oh yeah, that person's from the Canadian R&B scene.
Right.
There was really no scene, was there?
There's no scene. There was no scene. All of my influences came from America. In fact, even for, you know, when I used to travel to see my family in the States, I'd bring videotapes to videotape their television programming to see some videos, music videos, because we didn't have it on TV here.
No kidding.
We didn't get the same. We only got BET in this past decade or so.
That's true. Yeah, that's
right?
True.
So, you know, being born, I'm born Canadian. I'm here. This is it. This is where I'm from. This is where I was born. And, you know, so we're a lot. There's been people who have succeeded, Deborah Cox, Tamia, Melanie Fiona, et cetera, who have done R&B that still don't sell records in Canada.
Right.
And so I'm like, okay, Julie, the last thing, this is where it goes back to being cut from my mother's cloth. The last thing I want is for the next generation to not be able to eat in their own country. Like, you have to leave.
Right. It's the classic Canadian question, right? If you are successful and you want to reach that next level of success, it's always that question. Whether you're an actor, you're a singer, you're a dancer.
Yeah, comedian, whatever, yeah.
You got to leave. And it's funny, and I've always found that when I have this debate with other people, they'll say, oh, well, you know, they'll talk about people being sellouts by going to the United States. And I just think to myself, how is it that, like, what do we expect from people? Do we expect them to go to the point of bankruptcy? Do we expect them to go to the point where they never get to perform on that stage that they've been dreaming of as a child,
right,
just to stay true to their Canadian roots?
Right, to keep it real.
Right, and it's like, well, no, I mean, and one of the things too is, let's not kid ourselves, is that we both know that quite often when you share an idea in the United mm-hmm. States or places outside of Canada, it is so often more embraced.
Yes.
Than it is here.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Now I have to jump back in. Now let's take back. Let's go back to radio for a second.
Mm-hmm.
We hear Rihanna. We hear Beyonce. We hear Brandy, Kelly Rowland. We hear, like, I'm just naming the R&B, you know, pop R&B singers now.
Right.
Lauryn Hill, you know, the list goes on.
Right.
Yet, you go to radio with a Julie Black and you hear, oh, radio isn't, this isn't what radio's playing right now.
Right.
Canadian radio, you know.
And you, and you hear
you
that?
You hear, yes!
People tell you that your sound is not currently being played.
Yes.
That, how do you not strangle people?
Listen, it's so frustrating, Stuart. It's so frustrating. This is where I go back to saying, I'm starting over every single time.
Mm.
every single time. It's almost like sometimes I feel like slapping another name on my own album and on my own singles and seeing what happens.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Just, yeah, just, you know, or wouldn't it be interesting if you were to write a song and give it to somebody else and then they sing it the exact same way you would have, but it becomes a huge hit.
Huge hit. Huge hit. It's incredible. And so in my journeys, I'm like, okay, first of all, Julie, do your best to just not turn into angry black woman, because angry black woman, that's not going to work either.
Right.
And just continue to this is where my faith is the only thing that's been keeping me going. The only thing.
Right.
And the fact that music makes me so happy.
Mm.
And I see the joy that it brings to so many people. You know, I've had people come to my merch table afterwards, and it's like, you know, I have a brain tumor. This may be my last concert.
Wow.
And, yeah, like, it's like, okay, you know what, Julie, keep going.
Yeah.
Keep pushing. Keep fighting.
Yeah. You know what's funny? I got to tell you, it's almost on some kind of convoluted level nice to hear you saying this, even though I don't want to necessarily celebrate in your pain. But the reason it's nice to hear it is because it's too nice to know that I'm not alone. Because I feel the same way. You know, I've been on national speaking stage now for almost 20 years. I've spoken to over a million people. I have written I don't know how many speeches, how many shows. And then I'll get a phone call from someone who's asking me to do something that is something that, you know, I would have done 20 years ago.
Right.
And I feel
right.
like saying, I feel like just screaming out, and this is all my ego, I realize, but I'm like, did you read my bio before you called?
Yeah.
And you do feel you're constantly going back to the very beginning. I remember that great documentary that Jerry Seinfeld did called The Comedian. And
is it on Netflix? I promise you I'll go watch it today.
You know what? I think it is on Netflix.
You
have to see this. It's about him choosing to go back into comedy after Seinfeld finally came to an end. And it was interesting because he was known as Jerry Seinfeld on The Seinfeld Show. And that's
right.
basically all anyone ever really knew him as. And then now he found himself back at the very beginning and trying to prove himself as a comedian. And he has this very funny scene where he's in a little bar in Cleveland, and he gets up there and everyone's cheering, and there, you know, there's someone famous, that's Jerry Seinfeld, and he says, you know, I had the hit, the biggest running, you know, hit show of all time. We actually had this many million viewers every single time the show went on the air. And he goes off and he lists off all these statistics, and he goes, and now I'm in Cleveland. And it's such a great kind of way of I think, you know, making people realize that you can never just rely on the fact that you have quote unquote made it. Sometimes you do
right.
find yourself going all the way back to the beginning. And that's where it's so important to remind yourself as you do why you do it.
The intention. Absolutely.
Yeah.
The why is very, very, very important. And, you know, that's what gives it meaning. And that's what will give you your fresh start, you know, internally, like every day. Like, okay, all right, so this is why I'm
yes,
doing this.
That's right.
And not to mention, we can't discredit the fact that we have been given special talents,
mm-hmm.
special gifts.
Right.
You know, this isn't like you, Stuart, weren't you didn't just... There isn't another Stuart, like, and literally, like, not just okay. There's another Stuart, okay, cliche.
Mm-hmm.
What you have been capable of doing, and in bringing people together, in getting so many messages out. You know, I find it to be such a huge, awesome blessing and honor. You called me for your top 10 events,
right.
And it has to do something with meaning, like that right there, and to do it with confidence. Like, listen, you have to have some sort of belief in yourself and in your talents to be able to say, you know what, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to round up the troops,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to make sure it's successful.
Yes, yes.
Period, point blank.
Right.
You know, and you know, I, as I hear you speak about relating to me in the starting over again and et cetera, my perception of you wouldn't have been that. And so you've actually helped me on today, because you know, there's, I often look at others and say, wow, they got, it seems like they just have it really smooth and easy.
Right. Yeah. Isn't it funny the way that we look at others? My friend one time said to me, he says, the one thing that I do know in life is that everyone who looks at us, guaranteed, they always see us as being much bigger than we see ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't that so true? So now, so you're talking about, and we both agree that there's all, when you set intention, there's all these really great things that can come out of taking these risks, and in your case, becoming a singer, in my case, becoming a speaker. What is something on the opposite end? Like, what's something that kind of sucks about being, you know, a famous singer?
people think you don't need help. You know, there's like the people. There are people who are always wanting to be around, be part of your team. For instance, hey, what could I do to help? But I've come to realize in the recent past, I basically like hired a fan. Like a fan that I didn't realize was like a super fan.
Mm-hmm.
I put him on board to be an intern, and as it turned out, he just really wanted me to be his friend, and it got to the point where it caused so much, you know, grief throughout the team where I had to let him go. And so I didn't realize that some people just want to be close to me. So
right.
That kind of sucks because you don't know what their true intentions are. Because they're like, yeah, sure. You want me to do social media for you? Sure, I'll do that. And then before you know it, you know, you realize that their intentions were something totally different. So that part of it sucks. And then when you really need help, sometimes the help isn't there, and sometimes you stop yourself because my ego, my pride.
Right.
I feel, you know, okay, no, I can't ask for help. So it's those two things are kind of a tug of war between those two things in my life right now, being a singer.
Right. Yeah, it is amazing. I've had this happen to me so many times where an individual, really, they tell me all these really great things they're going to be able to do to help my company, and I think, wow, I'm so blessed, I'm so lucky, and you realize what it comes down to is they want to have lunch with you.
Thank you.
Right. Yeah, I know. And then you go you go for lunch, and then you ask them after that lunch meeting, like a week later, so how did, you know, all those things we talk about, are they coming together? Oh, well, you know what? I haven't really got around to it yet, but can we have another lunch?
Can we have another lunch? Oh, my goodness. I thought I was the only one.
Oh, no.
Like, to the point where I've been invited to people's kids' bar mitzvahs. It's like, yeah, just come to bar mitzvah. And, you know, and all these, you know, people, you will be able to talk business, you know, still, and da-da-da.
Right.
And then do follow-up lunch, follow-up dinner, follow-up. And, I mean, sure, I got lots of great food in my gut that I got to go burn off on the treadmill. But you just wanted to say that we're friends.
That's it. Yeah, I can't imagine, because I know that I get recognized probably 1/100th of the amount that you get recognized, and so I can't imagine what it must be like. I mean, I remember one time I was with a friend of mine, Adam, and we were having a drink at a bar, and this woman walked up to us, and we were having a really great conversation, and she interrupted it, and she recognized him from TV, and she really just wanted to speak to us, and I got to admit, it was kind of annoying, and Adam was a lot more used to it than I was, and perhaps I was taking more offense to it, but she had just interrupted a perfectly good conversation, and she just wanted to say to her friends, oh, I was speaking to somebody famous today. And the funny thing about Adam is that at that time, really, he was more famous for just doing, you know, pretty popular commercials. It wasn't like he was starring in a motion picture, a Hollywood motion picture. So what's it like for you? I mean, when people come up to you and they want to kind of be in your space, I mean, how do you handle that?
Well, I'm touchy-feely, so that actually, I embrace that. And there was a time where I saw an interview with JFK Jr. Years, like, long. I was living in New Jersey back in, like, early 2000, and you know, he'd take the train and this, that. And he was just such a people person, and it just locked into my brain. Like, that's the type of energy that I want to have,
right.
That type of tolerance and patience. I think that I had to also learn how to wrap it up quick. Like, it's just, you know, there's still certain techniques. Like, even when I go to the gym, I'll go to the gym clearly publicly, but I keep my headphones on and I read. Like, when if I'm on the treadmill, or, like, there's certain things that block people out where you just don't want to be disturbed. But otherwise, I welcome it. You know, I'm nothing without the fans. So really, I'm okay with it.
What's it been like for, you know, boyfriends in the past, lovers you've had in the past.
We might want to ask them. Yeah. What's it been like?
Does it bother you them to kind of see you being like, you know, the popular one, or are they pretty cool with it?
Nowadays it's fine because, you know, we, like, the person that I'm dating, we actually like work together. He's part of my whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So my popularity is our popularity.
Right. Okay.
But in the past it was really hard. It was really, really hard because it's like, it takes a confident, really confident man, or, you know, just mate, period, to be with somebody who's popular if they're not in that realm.
Right.
If, you know, it just really does. And it's sad. For me, it became sad at times because I'm like, I don't know what it's like to not be me. So, you know, that, like, I started in this business so young and then I got into television. And so, you know, people, there's a different generation, like a lot of like older people, like my mom's age, whether it's Marilyn Dennis or like the CTV stuff, where to them, you could do anything on TV and you're a mega star.
Right.
Anything on TV. So, you know, it's really about the other person being really, really confident in themselves.
Do you think that, you know, how do you feel about us men these days? Do you think that we are... how are we doing in our confidence level or our maturity? Or because I hear it from a lot of my female friends, they're quite worried about us males. And do you share the same concerns?
Well, I don't think that men are. I don't think anybody's any different really from the beginning of time till now. I think that at the end of the day, there's certain cycles that we're talking about men that just men have to go through to be ready to commit.
Right.
And so, you know, I think I actually have a problem. I think the women, I'm more worried about the women because more and more, there's just too much available to us. And let's go to the younger generation where they're chasing perfection. They want to look like this and they want to, you know, sound like that and become this. And so there's all these like unrealistic goals that actually put a lot of pressure on men. And I think that men will just shy away from that. Okay, no, I don't, like, some guys I know are like, forget Valentine's Day. You're not going to pressure me
right
to buy chocolates and da-da-da. But back in the day, the men, they were just kind of like, okay, Valentine's Day, sure, here's your rose and da-da-da. And I was like, nah, hell no. So what? So you could put it on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook to show, because there's a lot of, it's showing off, it's bragging, it's not real.
It is true, isn't it? Yeah.
You know, like, the back to intention, like, okay, so now you put on Facebook, it's complicated, or I'm in a relationship, or I'm not. Before all of those platforms were available, what was love? Like, how did you love before social media is the question.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it, how we, I never really thought about that, but our love is, for so many people, on display. I mean, even for someone's profile picture on Facebook, it's not just them, it's them and their partner. And,
you
know, we're now in this, and you're right, it's like, you know, who can show the best picture of the best Valentine's flowers,
yeah.
And it's amazing. And it's one of the things that I've been really noticing, and I can only really talk as a man about women because, I am a man, and last time I checked, you know, if I wasn't doing this naked right now, Julie, I may not know that.
Hey, oh, you're naked too?
Yeah.
All right.
We should have got that out in the open.
Hey, good thing we didn't Skype there. Okay.
So I'm meeting a lot of women these days who are, I think because of social media, they're continuously getting messaging that tells them I deserve a certain type of guy.
Yeah.
A certain type of partner. And so they're saying, well, I just saw a picture of Susan, and Susan had all these huge flowers for Valentine's Day, so I should too. Or I just saw this video or this, whatever it might be, to make them believe that they deserve it. And I genuinely believe that everyone deserves the greatest love, and you deserve the greatest partner, as long as you are the greatest partner.
Exactly. It's a two-way street.
Yeah, and I see these women that are so frustrated. They're like, I don't get what it is. I just cannot seem to land a date with the right individual. And then I'll say, well, what are you doing on yourself? Like, what work do you do on you to make sure that you deserve? And of course, it goes both ways. If a man wants to have a great partner, he too has to bring the things that he wants to the table.
Right. It's projection and reflection. What are you doing to attract that type of person?
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you're broken, you attract broken. You may not see it in the first 90 days because it's like there's some sort of money-back guarantee even with dating.
Yes.
But you will attract that which you are. It just is.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, I was talking to a woman recently who I had who I kind of knew just as an acquaintance. I saw her at a recent event, and she was telling me how frustrated she is not being able to meet somebody. And I said, well, you know what? Send me a message on Facebook. Add me as a friend on Facebook. I'll put up a posting on my Facebook page. I know a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
and I won't say your name, but I'll just say I know an attractive woman who has these kinds of characteristics. Here's what she's looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And I started getting male suitors who were showing interest, and I would connect her with them.
Right.
And I can tell you right now, I'm not making this up. These guys were, you know, all good enough looking dudes. They were interesting guys. And she didn't go on a date with any of them. And you think to yourself, you know, I kind of think I might know the reason you're single.
Yeah, picky.
There's a thing called the common denominator, and it's you.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
This is not just true, obviously, for relationships. It's people who think that they deserve the greatest job or people who whatever it be. And they're like, well, are you the candidate that deserves the greatest job or the greatest friendship or the greatest adventure? It always starts with you. And if you're not going to work on yourself.
It sure does. I can't seem to lose the weight. What are you eating? What are you doing? Are you moving?
Right.
You know, other than the fork?
Yes.
Your mouth? Like, for real.
I know,
I'm not saying it's easy, but hey.
And we're obviously, and I mean, and I know that we're joking around and we're laughing. We know that it's something that for some people that they really struggle with. And
absolutely.
And we understand that, but still, you know, you've got to put in that effort if you're going to get the results. And whether
it
doesn't matter what category it is. But listen, before we end up, you know, coming to a close in this call, I do want to ask you.
Have we been talking for an hour already?
I know, right?
Oh my gosh.
We're almost there. What is going on? So when is your album coming out?
The album is set for a fall release.
Okay.
It is called Made in Canada. So fall, I'm thinking October. It's called Made in Canada. And we are gearing up to release our singles over the next 8 weeks or so.
Okay.
Everything will be on social media. And, you know, for those of you listening, my parents, I don't know what they were smoking when they named me, but my name is spelled Jully. So now when I say Julie, you'll know the spelling.
Yeah.
So my Twitter is @JulieBlack. My Facebook is Julie Black. My Instagram is Miss Julie Black. Don't get it twisted. No, it's not don't get it twisted, but it is Miss Julie Black. And everything. It's easy to find me. And I actually respond to all of my messages myself, no matter how long it takes.
Right.
To the point where actually Facebook shut me down for spamming.
Oh, God.
Like, yeah. Like, you're basically on timeout. I'm like, oh, my gosh. Okay.
You were sent to the corner.
Totally.
Right.
Yeah.
What is one of your, and I know you, I'm sure you love every song on the album, but what's one of your favorite songs?
One of my favorite songs on the album, yeah, I do love every song, it's called The Moment.
Okay.
And it's a song that's just vocal, grand piano, and a quartet, a string section.
Okay.
It's very, very powerful, and it's basically about falling in love with your best friend. Like, you know,
Oh. We've
gone off too far, we're caught in the moment. It's like, we can't be friends, we've gone off too far, we're caught in the moment. You know, like, this is what it is right now, let's do it.
Oh, wow. And when you write a song, do you... Like, how does it come to you? Do you have to force yourself to sit and just kind of crank it out, or do you find yourself driving down the street and one day, and bam, it just hits you?
The subject may hit me when I'm just driving on the street, but I got to focus, sit, and crank it out. Crank it out right there, yeah, usually. And actually, The Moment was written by my producer, Young Pete. So he wrote the lyrics, I wrote the melody, and we put it together, yeah.
How does it feel? Do you have writing partners like quite often?
Not quite often, but for this album, I did. I found that I was ready to grow my sound. And you know, to me, I'm like, okay, I live in this house. Somebody built it. Somebody painted it. Another person did the driveway. Another person did the hardwood. I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's good to share ideas and to be able to be influenced by other creative types who are very talented and could actually stretch stretch my talent. Otherwise, it's kind of like getting a spot at the gym. Like, okay, I'm doing this with these weights, and I feel like I'm strong, but imagine if somebody spotted you, how much stronger you would be.
Oh, that's a great way of looking at that. Did you have to check your ego at the door, though, to kind of accept the fact that maybe you're not the only great writer on the planet?
Oh, I sure did. It was tough.
Was it?
It was tough. There was times where, you know, I was like starting to feel offended when I didn't do one of my lyrics. You know, I was like, no, let's say this instead. Or, oh, yeah, it was definitely a process for me, but one that I'm so happy that I am. I embrace it.
I just literally, about an hour ago, I came from a meeting with a very, very large company with a client, and I'm going to be going on a kind of a national road show with them starting very, very soon. And I was sitting in the room, and I shared all my ideas for the presentation that I'll be doing. And then it was my turn to sit and listen to feedback from about 8 different people in the room, all telling me what they thought I should and shouldn't be doing. And it's never easy. And I got to tell you, though, when you get to the point where you do it enough, you start becoming used to it. And then in this case, I've done it long enough where I was able to just sit in it, listen to their feedback, and it was wonderful feedback.
Right.
And now my presentation will only be that much better because it wasn't just a Stuart Knight thing. It was a collaborative thing.
Well, this is what I'm saying. Congratulations on what's coming up. Please keep us posted because I love hearing you speak.
Thank you. But
when I spoke to you, when you were able to give me my briefing for both top 10 events,
right,
you changed my life forever. You changed the way I approach speaking forever, single-handedly.
Oh,
forever.
My God. I never knew that.
Yeah. No word of a lie. Like, man, you have a way. I don't know if you do coaching, but it's something that if you don't, you might want to think of on the sidebar because you're able to just bring the idea in. You had me think about it. We spoke for maybe 15 minutes, but it totally just changed the way I approach. I'm not just saying approach. Now every talk that I do, I approach it the way you ask me certain questions. I kind of have the, like, when people say, what would Jesus do? I kind of have, like, what would Stuart ask me? For real. Like,
oh my God.
Really, really good. Really good.
You have literally just made my day. I mean, I can't even tell you how good that feels to hear someone like you say that. I remember the first time I met you, I was so nervous because I remember, isn't it funny? Like, we're friends now I remember backstage, this is a long, long time ago, and I remember being backstage and like, oh, there's Julie Black, and I walked into the room, and you are a touchy-feely person, and so am I, and you just walked up, you just hugged me.
Yeah.
You hugged me, I'm like, who is this person? This is not like the woman that I had made up in my mind who was going to be, you know, surrounded by an entourage.
Right.
And to now, so many years later, to have you to pay me such a lovely compliment, I can't tell you just how wonderful it feels, and I thank you. And I know that you know, anybody who's listening to this, they really do need to know that you very much are the real deal. I mean, you are every word you sing and everything that comes out of your mouth and every interview you give. It's never put on by you, which I really, really, I really love that about you. You genuinely are the kind of person that believes what you say and somebody who really walks the talk. And so
thank you, Stuart.
My pleasure. And thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I want you to know that people, I'm sure, are going to really love it, and I want people to be able to, you know, have had the opportunity to listen to someone like yourself who up until now they may have only known as that person who's on the billboard, but to have been able to hear that real Julie Black, J-U-L-L-Y.
That's it. Thank you. I love you so much, Stuart. This made my year. Like, oh, man, for real. I'm going through something right now, and this to start my day like this? Listen to this thing right here.
It's coming soon. It's coming soon. Well, thank you so much. Love you tons, and I hope to speak to you very, very soon.
Okay. Take care, honey.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the Stuart Knight Show. We hope you've enjoyed this powerful conversation. People are fascinating, and so are you. And the right questions will prove it.
Thanks for tuning in, everyone. I really enjoyed my conversation with the amazing Julie Black this week. She is such an incredible woman, and I really do encourage all of you to go grab a few of her songs on iTunes and add them to your playlist. She's on my playlist, and I love her music. It's so inspiring. For those of you who want to follow me, you can on Twitter at Stuart_Knight, or you can like my fan page on Facebook. And finally, it would mean the world to me if you just took a few seconds out of your day to share this podcast with your network. You can do that on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, or wherever you show up in cyberspace. And I want to engage this world in a powerful conversation. And together, we can make that happen. So please share it now. I look forward to connecting with all of you again next week. Until then, remember, powerful conversation, powerful life.